and textiles to Bolivian musical instruments and international home decor.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls. In this hour of Focus 580, we will have here as our guest Daniel Benjamin. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. He is the co-author of a recently published book that's entitled The Next Attack. The subtitle is The Failure of the War on Terror and a Strategy for Getting It Right. It is published by Times Books, in which he and his co-author, who is Stephen Simon, by the way, who teaches at Georgetown, they make the argument that, in fact, we are losing the war on terror, that we have become mired down in the occupation of Iraq. Jihadists continue to be a threat, attacking Western targets both in Europe and the United States. Osama bin Laden is still at large. All of those facts are in place. At the same time, he says that the United States can develop a new policy that does indeed take into account the realities of the terrorist threat that we face today. As we talk in this part of the show, of course, questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Just a bit more about our guest. In addition to now his involvement with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, he served between 1994 and 1999 on the National Security Council staff as a director for counterterrorism, and before that he was special assistant and foreign policy speechwriter for President Clinton. He's also been a foreign correspondent for Time and Berlin bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal, and he is joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Benjamin, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's certainly pretty clear that you and your co-author say right here the very first line in the book, in the prologue, is we are losing. That all of this time now after September 11th, with everything that we have done, the adjustments that we've made, continuing sort of conversation about what sort of security we need, we now have a Department of Homeland Security. We've made some changes, we hope, to the way we structure and gather our intelligence. Has any of that been beneficial?
Well, we may be a bit safer today because the country recognizes that there is a very large threat out there and people are much more vigilant than they were before. There have been some definite improvements. It is harder for terrorists to get into the country, although we are not and we will never be airtight. There have been some improvements in areas such as the fact that we found 20 million doses of smallpox vaccine. Some cities have done a terrific job in upgrading their intelligence and law enforcement operations, like New York. But overall, we believe, and I think we're not alone in this, that on the Homeland Security front, the last 3 years have been lost years because so much of the energy that should have been devoted to Homeland Security has gone into this colossal merger of the 22 different agencies into the Homeland Security Department, and it has been very poorly managed. There has not been a lot of leadership, and really until the appointment of Michael Chertoff as the new leader of the department, there was a real lack of priority. There was just no setting of, you know, priorities for what we had to do next, what was most important. And so there was an aimlessness to that effort. So we're not very optimistic about what's happened there. We do think that Judge Chertoff is an improvement, but we're a long way from where we should be on the Homeland Security side of things.
Mm-hmm. It seems that, you know, there's this old saw about how the military is always preparing to fight the last war, and it seems that you are making a similar kind of criticism when it comes to our approach to terrorism, in the sense that the nature of the threat has changed, and it is something that seemingly we have not acknowledge. Are we still putting too much emphasis on going after people who are associated with Al-Qaeda and have this preoccupation with Osama bin Laden and the people of the top leadership, when in fact that's not the primary threat anymore?
Well, let me back up a little and sort of amplify on your first remark. In the critical mistake of fighting the last war, in many ways, was going into Iraq. And let me just explain that by saying that we wrote this book in the belief that there were two unmistakable lessons of 9/11. One of them was that there were now non-state actors, a sort of Washington term for terrorist groups, who were as powerful, if not more powerful, that is, could inflict as much damage or even more than most states who oppose us could, and that was an important thing to take on board, that people needed to reorganize how they thought about security with that in mind. That was the first thing. The second thing was that we were in a very different kind of struggle because we were up against a social movement of which, you know, the terrorist groups are a part of. And we were not confronting states, and that we needed to think very hard about what the how we would confront and undermine their ideology, because it's the ideology that is the most dangerous thing here. It's the ideology that's spreading. It's the ideology that is making us less safe. And we felt that both of these lessons really had been lost on the Bush administration, and that by going into Iraq, they had really decided that they were, that the problem was not terrorist groups, these new terrorist groups, but rogue states. And in fact, there are many officials from the Bush administration who said their big insight was that terrorist groups couldn't do anything without state support. Well, that has turned out not to be correct. Now, moving on to your other remark about are we doing the wrong thing by going after al-Qaeda? No, we're not doing the wrong thing by going after al-Qaeda because those people remain dangerous, and we've had a number of intimations of how dangerous they are. We certainly blundered terribly in going into Iraq because we've now created essentially a new jihadist movement, an Iraqi jihadist movement, and we've probably also turbocharged the foreign jihadist movement of the people who are coming to Iraq to fight. We saw the evidence of this new Iraqi jihadist movement. Well, we see it every day because they're responsible for an awful lot of the attacks on Iraqi forces and on U.S. forces. But we also saw it in the bombings of the three hotels in Amman. And we had predicted that we were going to see trouble from Iraqi jihadists in our book, and this happened just days after the book came out. And that consequence of the war is something that no one was thinking about, that the war would radicalize a significant portion of the population, and that we would be facing more terrorists, not fewer.
Well, just to underscore that point, now the Bush administration, President Bush, has said the reason for our being in Iraq, the importance for being in Iraq, is that it is a base for terrorism, and we want to make sure that that thing is contained so that it doesn't spread out, get into the rest of the region, get into Europe, potentially the United States. His famous phrase is, you know, we want to fight them there rather than fighting them here. The response, I think, from a lot of people is that while that indeed might be true now, that it was not true before the United States toppled the regime of Saddam Hussein, and that, in fact, we have made it, by our action, we have made it a base for terrorism. We have made it a problem that it wasn't before. I assume that is an analysis that you would agree with.
Well, that's a core argument in our book, and I can illustrate it in any number of ways. There was no jihadist movement in Iraq before Saddam Hussein was toppled. There were currents of Islamization, of people becoming more drawn to radical Islam. And this was known among scholars, and the fact that the administration didn't recognize this and calculate that would be a problem post-invasion was one of many blunders. What was also true is that the administration absolutely refused the advice of the intelligence community, which was offered over and over again, that this would, as one of our sources put it, this would be a poster child for the global jihad, for bin Laden and those who follow him, and that's exactly what has happened. Now, the argument about fighting them there so we don't have to fight them here, that argument makes a certain amount of sense. We do want to fight them beyond our security perimeter, that is, outside of our, beyond our borders and beyond even the periphery, what separates us from our borders and what's way out there, so we don't have to worry about damage to our own people and our economy and so on and so forth. But you also have to recognize that there's a limitation in that regard because it only makes sense or it should affect the tools you use to fight that war, because there isn't a limited number of these people. There's a flexible number, and that number will grow depending on how you fight this war. You don't want to do something that will radicalize lots of people, that will confirm for them the jihadist argument and draw them to that camp, and that's precisely what Iraq did. One of the key arguments of our book is that by going into Iraq, what we did was confirm bin Laden's argument about us to many of the Muslims in the world who were already deeply skeptical about American intentions. And the bin Laden's argument is America is our preordained enemy, and it seeks it and its allies seeks to occupy Muslim countries, steal their wealth, and destroy their faith. And we think we went into Iraq for very benign and even generous reasons, and I have no doubt that we're sincere about that. But by doing what we did, we lent our enemies ammunition in this war of hearts and minds, and they have made excellent use of it.
So just to, and you certainly would not argue that that all of those people who have this now, this negative opinion in the United States, are going to become terrorists. But yet what it does is it creates a foundation, a rising tide of resentment and negative feelings about the United States that can be a kind of a ground on which terrorism can indeed.
Oh, absolutely. Grow. And just to underscore what you were saying, the overwhelming majority of the world's Muslims have no interest in violence and are not going to attack the United States, and we should be doing everything we can really to undermine the terrorist ideology so that those people feel that we are on the same side. But terrorism is it doesn't take a huge number of people to make for a really big terrorism problem. It is at the margins that we have to worry about it, and I think that we did not serve ourselves well by going into Iraq and essentially putting a lot of young radicals into play and making them making the jihad attractive to them. And one of the reasons that we say we're losing, by the way, and we can talk about this more, is that we see a lot of groups appearing that are sort of self-starters, that haven't been recruited by al-Qaeda, but have actually signed up for the jihad themselves, taught themselves how to be terrorists with the materials that are available to them over the Internet, and are acting up without any integral connection to al-Qaeda. And that is really worrisome.
Let's get on to that in just a moment here. But where you want to, for the benefit of anybody who might have tuned in here, I'd like to introduce again the guest. We're talking this morning with Daniel Benjamin. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. He served on the National Security Council staff as the director for counterterrorism. He was also special assistant and foreign policy speechwriter for President Clinton. He is the co-author, along with Stephen Simon, who teaches at Georgetown University, of a book that came out in October. The title of the book is The Next Attack, The Failure of the War on Terror and a Strategy for Getting It Right. It is published by Times Books, and certainly you could find it in the bookstore. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think just to go back to the main points you made here, first of all, that among the important lessons of 9/11, the fact that now the United States has to deal with some powerful non-state actors, and to take that a step further, now we have groups that essentially are self-starters. And I think perhaps one of the great case studies, one of the first illustrations you offer in the book, were the bombings in Spain in March of 2004.
Absolutely. We devote a chapter to reconstructing that and to demonstrate just how much damage a group that really comes out of nowhere can do these days. First of all, there's we live in an age in which technologies of destruction are becoming ever more available. This is a group that had contacts with an older generation, earlier generation of jihadists, but had not been recruited into organizations. There was one who had some contact with an Algerian group, but even so, he doesn't seem to have been the key player in this group. But most of them were just immigrants. And there were two things that really agitated them. One was that after 9/11, a lot of the people they knew were arrested. and the dragnet that swept through Spain. But what seems even more important to them was Iraq. And Iraq was on all of their lips and was clearly a key motivation. They loved to watch a video that showed the killing of a number of Spanish intelligence agents. That happened, I think, in 2003, and they would sit around and watch that. And they would talk about how Spain had to pay for its support of the United States. And they talked about blowing up Spain's Madrid's major soccer stadium. And, you know, these guys were basically amateurs, and they put together a plot in which they managed to detonate 10 of 13 bombs almost simultaneously. They could have killed an awful lot more people if the Spanish train system had been as efficient as the bombers were, because one of the trains that got bombed was a few hundred yards from the station, and that would have actually probably caused great damage in a thickly populated station. And this group appeared in the blink of an eye from a terrorism perspective. It constituted itself and carried out this attack in less than 6 months. And that's very hard for an intelligence or law enforcement service to track and to identify.
We have a caller here. Let's bring him into the conversation. Someone in a fairly nearby community, Gibson City, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Comments. As I've been listening, one of the things that I picked up was that your guest mentioned the word struggle against terrorism, and it seems to me that, especially since 9/11, that part of the problem we're losing the war on terrorism is because we immediately jumped to the war analogy. And what happens then is what I've seen from people that I know and from what I've seen coming out of Washington, D.C., is that by using the war on terrorism, we close off other avenues in our thinking. And if we could recast it as a struggle against terrorism, which may not sound as politically, I don't know, but by casting it as a struggle, we open up a lot of possibilities that war closes down. The problem with the war is that we are trying to respond to violence with violence, which human beings have been doing for millennia and hasn't worked yet. But if we work as a struggle, yes, there are violent people out there that need to be dealt with, but the underlying ideological battles, as your guest has said, we seem to be losing, and I think it's because of that commitment to the war mentality. And I'll hang up and listen to your comments.
Well, all right, Mr. Benjamin, you want
well,
to
I think ahead? The I think the caller makes excellent points, and these are points that we discuss at great length too in our book. Let me tell you how I see it. I was a presidential speechwriter, and I think that it was a sort of linguistic inevitability after 9/11 that someone was going to declare war on terror. And because when American presidents want to show that they are maximally serious, they declare war. We've had wars on poverty, on cancer, on inflation, you name it. And there is a problem with that, and it doesn't play well, particularly with some of our foreign allies. Part of that has to do with their own cultures and traditions and their language. I mean, war in German, Krieg, is something very different from war in English. The word itself is both inevitable and unfortunate. What I think is more unfortunate is exactly what the caller was referring to, which is that if we take this analogy too seriously, it shuts off other options. And in particular, what shuts off other options is if we actually start waging war, because it has this radicalization effect and because we lose the moderates then. It is unfortunate that we, alienate European allies by using, and I'm just using Europe as an example, that by using the term war, we are losing a lot more friends in the world by actually waging a war. It is one thing to talk about it. It's another thing to preside over the turmoil in which upwards of 30,000 people have been killed. And one of our points in this book is that we have, in fact, really over-militarized the struggle against terror, because the military is an excellent tool for some things, but it's a blunt tool for going after terrorists, because terrorists are rarely interested in, at least at this stage, in holding on to territory and in fighting pitch battles. And we have seen this in Iraq, where the U.S. military has gone into Anbar province time after again, and the terrorists see us coming and they slip away. And we will take a town. Sometimes, you know, there will be other insurgents there who will fight the war. But when we depart, the terrorists slip right back into town and set up operations again. It's an intelligence and law enforcement problem above all. And we will actually be paying a big price for having waged a war in Iraq, because there is now a terrorist sanctuary in western Iraq, in Anbar province. And we won't root those people out until there is an intelligence service in Iraq capable of operating there. And that could be quite a while, because Anbar province is 97-98% Sunni, and there just aren't a lot of Sunnis who want to work there against the regime's opponents. And that's going to be an enduring problem. But anyway, to get back to what the caller was saying, these are all very important points. And we should be thinking about this struggle against terror as, what do we do to capture and or kill terrorists? And what do we do to keep other people from becoming terrorists? And if we use those two principles or those two questions as our guidelines, I think we would come out in a very different place.
Hmm. It seems to me that after the attack of September 11th, there were people who were who made the argument that it was at some time it was bound to happen again, that there was bound to be another terrorist attack inside the United States. The administration, I think, has pointed to the fact that it, so far it has not happened, as a sign that our approach to terrorism has worked. And now I know that there are a lot of people who say that's really dangerous to think that way, and that, in fact, among people who are concerned with responding to terrorism, there's a growing kind of complacency. That is, that people are not as perhaps as worried as they once were, and the concern is that then that means that they're not as vigilant as they were once. Why? Just let me ask you the question that you pose here in one of the, it's the first line of one of the chapters in the book, and that is, why is it there has been no second September 11th? Why is it that it has not, so far, it has not happened again?
Well, it's, of course, the question everyone's asking. And I think your description of the situation is exactly on point. Let me just say that there are a lot of reasons why it hasn't happened. Some of them are ones that I think the U.S. government can take some credit for, and that is, it's harder to get in. We have, I'm not sure this is one that that anyone should be taking credit for, but it's an important thing to note. The American Muslim community has shown itself to be, by and large, immune thus far to the virus of jihad, and you know, that's terrific. And I think a lot of that is because it's a very different kind of community than, for example, what we see in Europe, where in fact you have a whole different kind of population of people who didn't expect to be, were not expected to be living there for a long period of time, and who are now there and are deeply alienated, have not been integrated, so on and so forth. In America, the Muslim community earns more, is more educated than the population at large on average, and is you know, here because it wants to live the American dream, to put it in a very, you know, shorthand sort of way. But there are other things to consider as well. One is that the terrorists are getting a lot of what they need in Iraq. The theater, in a sense, shifted. We are watching something going on within the Muslim community. We're watching a group trying to seize the allegiance of much of the Muslim community, and they're doing that by saying, you know, we're the guys who are going to stand up to the United States, to the big enemy, and just watch how brave and valorous we will be, and how determined we will be, and how unflinching we will be, and we will attack with everything we have. And this has you know, played to their advantage. They have shown that they were the guys who were going to stand up to the United States. And, you know, the better part of strategy would have been to deny them the opportunity to kill Americans, because killing Americans is really the coin of the realm here. That's what they need to do to show that they are who they say they are. But we have created this theater, and everyone in the Muslim world is watching it. And a lot of people are horrified, but some are attracted. And we know that the jihadist groups in Iraq are putting out videos every day and situation reports every day about all the operations they're carrying out, and showing them killing either Americans or Iraqis, blowing up Humvees, blowing up Bradleys, you know, rocketing different installations, you name it. And this has become the story, you know, and they're living the war as a kind of heroic story, in the same that way that we lived Vietnam in our living rooms as a tragic story. And so, you know, they're getting a lot of what they need there. And then the other things to say are that we know from the ideology, we know from reading the terrorists, that they believe that when they attack the United States, they have to carry out a real spectacular. It has to top what they did before. Well, that's hard to do, and it takes time. And they're living on a different timeline. So, you know, they're going to wait until they really have that operation all teed up. And so, you know, you take all those different factors and the fact that can't be overlooked that the core al-Qaeda, the al-Qaeda that carried out 9/11, has been degraded, is not as capable as it was before. And I think it's safe to say we're between waves right now, at least in terms of the homeland, but we don't know how long that will last.
Our guest in this hour at Focus 580 is Daniel Benjamin. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. From 1994 until 1999, he served on the National Security Council staff as director for counterterrorism. Before that, he was a special assistant and foreign policy speechwriter for President Clinton. He's also been a foreign correspondent for Time and Berlin bureau chief for The Wall Street Journal. He is the co-author, along with Stephen Simon, of a book that was published in the fall, the book titled The Next Attack, The Failure of the War on Terror and a Strategy for Getting It Right. That's the subtitle. And Times Books is the publisher. Questions are welcome. In fact, we have a couple of people here ready to go. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call in, 333-9455. That's for folks here locally where we are. We do also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here ready. The next person is in Savoy, not too far away from here. Line number one. Hello.
Oh, yeah. Hi. How you doing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the end of World War II, you know, the Japanese really, they thought that they could stonewall everybody and negotiate negotiate some terms that were favorable to them and keep everything that they've got. And they basically ignored the Potsdam Declaration. And whenever the two atomic bombs were dropped, the realization came over them after the second attack that, oh yeah, these people mean business. They might wipe us out. Now, it may take that kind of determination to end this. And do you really think that that these terrorist organizations think it might come to that?
Is the question that the are the terrorists understand how much resolve we have?
Oh yeah. Do they really think that that might, you know, that could be what they ultimately face or not?
Well, I don't know. I think that it's pretty implausible to think about us using a nuclear weapon against anyone, because aside from everything else, you know, the fact that we don't have any countries that oppose us in such a dangerous manner, you know, and that using the weapon would just kill almost entirely innocent people in large numbers. It seems to me it's just,
if they got a hold of one, do you think they'd use it?
I do, but I think that's what we call asymmetrical warfare, and that's one of the reasons why it is so important to accelerate the work that's being done with Russia to secure nuclear materials there and to expand those programs into a number of other countries where there is fissile material.
Well, what you have to do is whenever you're dealing with something like this is you've got a couple choices. You either take away their ability to make war, which means bringing a real conventional war to them. What we've got now is not a real war. But in order to get the job done, you'd have to take over the whole region and essentially do the same thing that we did during World War II, which is take away their ability to carry out warfare. And that means wrecking their economies and destroying everything in your path. And that does, believe it or not, that does have an effect. But we don't have the political resolve to do it. And therefore, you know, we've got a real problem on our hands. The other aspect...
I'm sorry, but as a general rule, we don't destroy other countries when the vast majority of their inhabitants don't oppose us.
Well, you're talking about taking away their ability to have access to the materials, the support, and the transportation, the communication.
Well,
about bringing a real war to the region.
Yeah, but first of all, you're making, I think, one mistake here in thinking that this is a phenomenon that's confined to one region. Even if we had the political will, and I thank God we don't, to dominate the Middle East, you know, the part of the world that has probably the fastest growing population of radicals is Western Europe, and we're certainly not going to conquer Western Europe.
Well, they don't have the free access to the war materials in Europe that they do in the Middle East.
Well, there's an enormous amount of explosive capabilities, and they might be able to get fissile material. They certainly can make dirty bombs. I just disagree with your premises here, I'm afraid, and I think that the kind of warfare that you're describing is something that we don't have the political will to carry out, and it would be unwise to do so because we would simply ensure the hostility of generations
to
come, and we would kill an awful lot of innocent people. And I think, as Iraq has shown, killing innocent people isn't really helping us.
Well, basically, you know, it's going to be impossible to make peace with these people, okay? Especially, and really, it's a job for the neighbors. And the thing that amazes me the most is you know, you can have a bomb go off yesterday in Iraq and kill several, you know, like 120 people, 100 people. And I mean, the neighbors, I mean, there's not even a press conference from Riyadh, Tehran, or anywhere else deploring it and saying that they're going to do something about it. And I'll tell you what, that's a real problem. And it may take an extraordinary measure to shock them back to reality.
Well, what is it you're suggesting that they do?
I don't see any press conferences in Riyadh saying to stop it.
Well, actually, I mean, the Saudis have been very outspoken about deploring terror in Iraq. You know, I think that's a misperception.
Well, we sure don't see it.
Well, I think maybe you ought to talk to your local station.
Well, it doesn't show up on the internet anywhere where their actual leaders have come out and said we're going to, you know, that we want it to stop. We're going to do something about it, and we deplore it. You don't see it, man. You just don't.
Well, I actually think you should start reading some of the translations of the Arab language press because there certainly is plenty of that. There's also a certain amount of just befuddlement as to what you do when there's that kind of turmoil in a neighboring country.
Well, then I guess though I find myself thinking, going back to the comments of the previous caller, who said maybe the war metaphor for what it is we're we're dealing with here is the wrong metaphor. It makes me think of some of the things that people, particularly people in Congress, said immediately after September 11th. They said, this is like Pearl Harbor. And I guess myself, my reaction was, no, this is not like Pearl Harbor, and this is not World War II. And yet is somehow that we can't quite get our heads around it, the fact that that dealing with terrorism, because of the nature of terrorism, as you've said, because what we're dealing with is powerful non-state actors, and particularly we have groups that appearing now that are self-starters, you simply cannot use the same strategy you would if you were fighting a war with another state. It's not like being able to declare war on Germany. It's a completely different thing.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, the administration was saying a lot before and even in the early part of the occupation of Iraq that it was going to be just like Japan and Germany. But the fact is, in those cases, you know, we really did obliterate those countries. And we destroyed their cultures, their political culture, certainly. And, you know, we're just not going to do that absent a 4 or 5 year world war. And I don't think that it's a serious way to go about it. We really do need to win over moderates. That will actually be a much more cost-effective way of doing it, too, because, you know, one of the arguments in our book is that we need to promote a reform agenda, and we do need to push democracy in the region along with the rule of law and other things that will provide for a better future for people who live in the Middle East. And you could have bought a lot of reform for the several hundred million dollars that we've spent on war in Iraq. War is really expensive.
Yeah. At the same time, I'm sure that you wouldn't be arguing that we don't at the same time need to use to pursue force as a way of going after people who have committed terrorism. I mean, that's still got to be part of the response.
Absolutely. I think that there is a role for the military in this, but it's a role that has gotten rather exaggerated in the last few years. We do need to have our special operations forces that are capable of going after terrorists, especially in areas that aren't well governed. In parts of Southeast Asia, in Yemen, and in other places where there is, you know, just an absence of authority. Mm-hmm. At the same time, most of the people we are going to want to catch and put out of business are hidden in cities that are governed by friends of ours, and they're hard to find. Bombing neighborhoods is not the way to do it.
Well, you have said very clearly that you think that going into what we did in Iraq was a mistake. Was the United States action going into Afghanistan correct?
It was absolutely correct, and I was a strong supporter from the beginning. In fact, my office in the NSC and my boss in particular, Richard Clark, lobbied for earlier action against Afghanistan. If anything, I think that we erred in Afghanistan by not doing the job as thoroughly as we should have, and we interview a number of senior Pentagon officials and generals in the book who said, you know, the problem is we fought to defeat the Taliban and al-Qaeda and not to destroy it there, and that we would have done a better job had we not shifted so many resources out of Afghanistan so quickly to the Iraqi theater. And that is another theme that we explore, how some of the really critical assets, the best special operations guys, the drones, the satellite time, all that sort of thing, was actually being cut back in Afghanistan before it should have been.
Let's talk with someone here on a cell phone, line 2. Hello.
Hi there, Al. I'll ask my question, then I'll hang up. But one thing, a little bit of a follow-up on the other guy's caller, is one thing I don't hear about in the United States is the mass population of people who are happy that we're there. And if the Iraqi press or even Arab press in general is actually saying, hey, let's stop this stuff, let's We don't agree with the insurgency, things of that nature. I just don't, in our country, because I'm not a, a news junkie where I go on the internet and actually follow stuff. Just I don't hear it on a day-to-day basis that the Iraqi people or even the region's people are against this. So I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Well, I'm not sure I fully understood. 80% of Iraqis now would like us to leave. That's my understanding. Now, my guess is they don't want us to leave from one day to the next, but they do want us to leave. And it is certainly true that the overwhelming majority of Iraqis from every every side, that is the Kurds, the Shia, and the Sunni, the large majority are appalled at what's happening in their country and the sectarian violence. And, that's something that's deeply, deeply, I think, dispiriting to them. I think that they've been quite clear about, and I think that most in the Muslim world have been too. And if, one of the curious twists is that if anything has caused the jihadist problems, it is the excessive tactics of people like Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who has just been too random, too indiscriminate in his violence, killed too many Shia, killed too many people, period, and not really targeted those enemies who everyone agrees should be targeted, or at least, for whom there is a belief that there's justification. I'm not supporting him in any way, shape, or form. I'm just saying that because he's been killing Iraqis of lots and lots of Shia, there's been a backlash. And that is undermining the ideology a bit. But there is a lot of sense in among the various communities that this is a nightmare for them. And, in some ways it's actually, it would have been a lot worse had the Shia community not shown really great patience, and that the militias have not done more in terms of attacking the Sunni community. So far, we have been somewhat lucky in that regard. It could be a lot worse.
We just have about 10 minutes left. Very quickly, let me introduce again the guest, Daniel Benjamin. He's senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. He also served from 94 until 99 on the National Security Council staff as director for counterterrorism. He's the co-author of a book, The Next Attack, which looks at the failures of the United States in the war on terror. Came out in October, published by Times Books. We have another caller here on Champaign, where we are, line number 3. Hello.
Yes, you said a moment ago that the goal was to capture or kill terrorists. I wonder what you'd say about the car bombing in Beirut in 1985 outside a mosque that killed 80 people in the mosque, mainly women apparently, and people in the neighborhood. Would there be a right to attack the base of the perpetrators of this particular act of terrorism?
There have been so many attacks in Beirut that at the moment I'm not quite sure which one you're talking about.
So, but on the general principle of capturing and killing terrorists, it would be appropriate to attack the basis from which that terrorist bombing came, right?
Well, I think in general we want to put out of business people who carry out terrorist attacks.
But in this case, those bases are in London and in Washington, because that attack was carried out by the CIA and British intelligence. So there would be a right, you would say, to attack London and Washington in order to capture and kill terrorists?
Well, I have to tell you, I worked in the government, and I don't know of any such terrorist attacks that were organized by U.S. or British authorities.
Well, this particular one is talked about by Bob Woodward in his book, Veil, page 396 and following. And as we know, it was publicized a couple of years after the fact as a CIA operation. And, of course, we know the largest CIA operation in history was the terrorist structure that was put in place in Afghanistan, from the Carter administration on. I mean, it seems to me the difficulty with your account of terrorism is that it proves too much. It says, essentially, that one could plant bombs in Langley, Virginia, or in Whitehall, because one would be responding to terrorist outrages.
Well,
CIA and British intelligence have carried them out in the Middle East.
Well, first of all, I want to dispute your description of what happened in Afghanistan the United States did not create the Taliban. The United States funded...
Well, not the Taliban. It was the who created the people who, like Osama bin Laden, were sent in from the by Zbigniew Brzezinski and the Carter administration to create a Vietnam for the Soviet Union, as they said.
Well, it is certainly true that the United States decided that it wanted to pin down the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, but the United States did not have anything to do with Osama bin Laden. There was a rebellion by Afghans underway. It was overwhelmingly an Afghan struggle. The Arab Afghans actually contributed very little.
Brzezinski said they sent the people in before the Afghan struggle began, before the Russians invaded Afghanistan.
They didn't send in foreign Arabs.
That's exactly what Brzezinski said they did.
I'm unaware of that, and since I work two floors above him, I think I would know that. But
ask him about the interview he gave to L'Observateur in France, where he claimed credit for that.
Okay, well, look, all I can tell you is that the United States and other countries are not justified in carrying out terrorist violence. I am unaware of any such actions that you're discussing. However, I do think that states have a right to defend themselves against terrorist violence. And so, for example, you know, I worked on the cruise missile strikes against Afghanistan and Sudan in 1998 after the bombings of our embassies. So, you know, I think we need to get our categories right.
Yes.
You know, I do think that we need to be very clear about what we're talking about.
The category seems to be that it's terrorism when they do it and it's not terrorism when we do it. And as long as that double standard is in place, it seems to me there's no reason the world sees the U.S. as there's no reason to doubt why the world sees the U.S. as a perpetrator of terrorism across the globe, as they do.
Okay, well, frankly, I'm just not prepared to concede the points that we have engaged in terrorist attacks anywhere. So I think we have a problem arguing this point. I would also point out that some of the smartest counterterrorism things we have done have not involved violence. For example, Brent Scowcroft was brilliant not to retaliate after Pan Am 103, but rather to gather the evidence and to force Gaddafi into a corner, to put UN sanctions on Libya, and to ultimately get Libya out of the business of terror. So, you know, I think it's a bigger and more nuanced story than you're telling.
I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me because we're getting down to the point here. We have a couple of minutes left. And what I wanted to ask you to do, just as a way of finishing up, as we have talked about or you have talked about the mistakes that you feel that the United States has made to this point, invasion of Iraq being one, what now, what should the United States do?
Well, the United States needs to do a lot of things. It needs to come up with a policy that undermines the ideology, that stops its spread, that keeps more people from becoming terrorists, and that essentially stops this movement in its tracks. It's going to take a long time. There are a number of things that we can do. To begin with, we should work to tamp down the regional jihads that are feeding the global struggle. There is fighting going on in Chechnya, in Southeast Asia, in Kashmir, and we need to start intervening diplomatically. We need to push diplomatic solutions to these problems because they are feeding the bigger jihad. I think we need to not engage less or detach ourselves from many of the countries in which radicalism is brewing in the Middle East and South Asia. We need to engage more, and we do need to push a reform agenda, and we need to do it in a way that's more, shall we say, full-bodied. I think one of the problems we've had is that the reform agenda from the administration has been largely rhetorical. And one of the arguments we make in this book is that we need to make them an offer they can't refuse, and that is through a mixture of trade deals and aid and other kinds of assistance. We need to show them that the United States really is the benign country that is interested in peaceful modernization that it claims it is, and that it really does want to have a better future for Muslims as well as for others. In the same vein, I think we need to be much more active in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The light largely went out on this for the administration after it saw when it saw the political cost to President Clinton. from his work on Camp David and Taba. This is still the number one issue for Muslims around the world, and the sense that the United States is indifferent to the suffering of Palestinians is literally killing us. We don't have to force an agreement, but we need to be active in promoting a peace deal. And finally, I would say that we need to recognize the costs of Iraq, and that should push us to get out sooner rather than later. I don't advocate a hasty pullout. I don't advocate a date certain right now. But I think we have to recognize that as long as we are in Iraq, we will have a very hard time turning around the perceptions of Muslims around the world, and particularly those who are most likely to turn to violence.
Well, there we will have to leave it with the promise that I'm sure at some of these issues we'll get back to again with other guests, other programs. If you're interested in reading the book that we've mentioned, again, it's titled The Next Attack, The Failure of the War on Terror and a Strategy for Getting It Right. It's published by Times Books. Our guest, Daniel Benjamin, is senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington from 1994 to 1999. He served on the National Security Council staff as director for counterterrorism. Mr. Simon, thank you very much.
I'm Mr. Benjamin.
pardon me. That's the co-author
is
Stephen Simon. Yeah. You are indeed Daniel Benjamin. And Mr. Benjamin, thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
The program here on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue, downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. Focus also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates. This year, celebrating their 23rd anniversary, Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Tomorrow morning on our program in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking a little bit about the health of the Great Lakes and also their future. And our guest there will be William Sullivan. He is associate professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at the U of I. And then in hour number two, we will talk with Paul Pearson. He's professor of political science at the University of California, Berkeley. And he is the co-author of a book that we'll talk about. The book is entitled Off-Center, The Republican Revolution and the Erosion of American Democracy. That's a subtitle. That's tomorrow. We are here weekday mornings 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. Right now, we hope you'll stay tuned because up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we will talk about the role popular magazines play in the construction of historical narrative. Our guest will be journalist Carolyn Kitsch. She is the author of Pages from the Past, History in Memory in American Magazines. Let's take a look now at the latest commodity prices. Kansas City March wheat is trading at $3.87 and a quarter, down $3.25. Now to the Chicago Board of Trade, where March wheat is